far-right protests in Dover last year.
Here in Cardiff today, an act of kindness and compassion towards asylum seekers who come here from far and wide, from the Middle East and Africa, among them doctors and engineers. Contrast this with the kind of hostility and hate they have been receiving from some people who think that their country is under invasion by irregular immigrants.
One of the consequences of coronavirus has meant the country's already overloaded asylum application system has ground to a halt, leaving these men living a life of wait and see.
Many people have been living here in limbo, not knowing when their asylum process is going to be progressed. And of course you have some people here who are separated from their family. They have family.
Britain remains the fifth most favorite European destination for refugees and asylum seekers, way behind Germany, France, Spain, and Greece. Keenan and other refugees and asylum seekers have survived war and the perilous voyage here, but their journey to call it their new home is yet to end. Saeed Pourreza, London.
While millions of Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's continued seizure of oil ships, an Emirati oil tanker named Saga has arrived at Bir Ali port in Shabwa in eastern Yemen to transport 115,000 tons of Yemeni crude oil to the UAE.
Oil smuggling carried out by the Saudi-led coalition in southern and eastern provinces has cost Yemen more than $7 billion over the past 2 years. Annually, more than 14 million barrels of crude oil are being smuggled illegally through several ports in Shabwa province, which is under the control of Saudi Arabia.
Meanwhile, Yemen's petroleum company says another oil tanker named Apollitaris is on its way to Deva port in Al Mukalla to move more than 300,000 tons of oil to an unknown destination.
Yemen is being systematically plundered by Saudi Arabia. An estimated $145 million of oil income is being looted monthly. Recently, an Emirati ship arrived at Shabwa port to plunder 1 million barrels of crude oil, and there is another ship coming from China to transport over 2 million barrels of crude oil.
Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued detention of 10 patrol ships by Saudi Arabia, while the vessels are inspected and authorized by the UN through verification and inspection mechanism.
Yemenis say plundering their oil is an illegal act that reveals the real reasons for the years-long war on their country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It was a pitched battle in garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistan's capital Islamabad. The violent clashes erupted after what protesters blamed the government to have backed out of its agreement with them to expel the French ambassador to Pakistan over the repeated incidents of public display and republication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Many died and dozens of others injured from the both sides in the clashes after the protesters blocked the major railways and road links. Protesters claimed that at least 10 of their companions were killed and over 100 were arrested by the police.
This government doesn't care about the dignity of our Prophet. Obviously, people take to the streets to show their anger. We gave the government 5 months to expel the French ambassador, but they did not expel him. We will continue our protests until our demand is met, which is the expulsion of French ambassador.
Pakistan has a history of similar violent protests over the frequent incidents of blasphemy of the Prophet under the guise of freedom of expression in the West. Protecting the honor of the Prophet is the most sensitive issue in Pakistan, which attracted millions of people on the roads in the past.
Sending the French ambassador back may be a kind of a step which again could provide an immediate relief as far as the domestic political scene is concerned, but that is not going to solve the problem. Today it is France, tomorrow it will be another country. And so we need to be having a comprehensive campaign.
Pakistan has been under pressure from Paris-based anti-money laundering outfit, the Financial Action Task Force, which placed Pakistan on grey list a few years ago on the charges of terror financing. Now Pakistan needs French support together with other countries to come out of the grey list, because of which Islamabad is reluctant to expel French ambassador. However, rising anti-French sentiments in Pakistan are leaving little option with the government but to expel French ambassador. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Restaurateurs, gym owners and business people from various other industries have continued to stage protests across Italy demanding the government to immediately lift the ban on their activities. A protest dubbed Io Apro, I Open, was staged in central Rome. Hundreds of angry business people tried to head towards the parliament building but were met by police in riot gear and had to detour to nearby San Silvestro Square. Here they shouted, "Freedom and let us get back to work," with some hurling smoke flares and other objects.
Under Italy's current red and orange zone restrictions, restaurants remain closed at night and are open for takeaway only during the day, whereas swimming pools and fitness centers are closed all day.
We are exasperated by the situation and by the way the police treat us. This is just repression. They do not even allow us to demonstrate. The government must let us return to our work. We have lost 60-70% of our earnings.
The protest turned nasty when protesters infiltrated by alt-right activists and professional organizers of social unrest threw firecrackers and objects at police. Officers charged the protesters after they tried to breach a police cordon.
The government keeps ignoring us. My shop has been closed since October, but the rent and all bills must be paid anyway. How can we continue this way? I am afraid some people will resort to extreme acts.
Meanwhile, restrictions were eased across most of Italy after six regions were downgraded from red to orange on Monday. However, Prime Minister Mario Draghi has said Italy will have no moderate risk yellow zones this month in an attempt to keep the spread of the virus down while his government tries to step up a much-delayed vaccination campaign. Max Civili, Rome.
Increasing the number of...
Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. That is a fact. But according to a senior former British civil servant, Philip Reitcraft, the COVID-19 pandemic has seeded the idea of a Prime Minister who speaks for England alone. In a study looking at the issues of devolution from inside the UK state machinery, the former permanent secretary to the Brexit department stated that the 300-year-old union is in deep peril due to no defined strategy by Westminster.
In the context of COVID, where each of the constituent nations' devolved governments are essentially self-governing, this has inculcated a sense that Britain is not a unified nation, the UK is not unified, and it's never been more divided and never been more angry. And to all intents, I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson, at least unofficially, is the Prime Minister of England only. He doesn't seem to care about the union.
The crisis has been exacerbated amid growing momentum for a second referendum on Scottish independence, with a recent poll showing that pro-independence parties would win 79 of 129 seats in Holyrood in the upcoming elections. Moreover, there's also a growing independence movement in Wales that will add to Westminster's woes. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, there's been a serious deterioration of relations between the nationalist and loyalist communities following the implementation of the Brexit deal, which has resulted in some of the worst street violence to have taken place in recent years.
I think Northern Ireland has been used as a pawn. It's been used as a pawn by the British government. It's been used as a pawn by the European Union.
The report, co-authored by Professor Michael Kenny, claimed it was political decision-making made by Westminster mixed with a lack of consultation with dissolved government and confused messaging that has caused widening divisions. with Rivecraft claiming that Boris Johnson's muscular brand of unionism had asserted the value of the union rather than demonstrating it.
Boris Johnson and his crew of hard right ideologues have substituted flag-waving British nationalism for clear-headed policy designed to make people in different parts of the UK feel they're part of something united rather than increasingly polarised. And when the flag-waving starts, the thinking stops. And when the thinking stops, the road to ruin is set. And this UK is on a road to ruin.
The warnings laid out in this new report are stark. Unless there's a change in strategy from Downing Street, then the future of the United Kingdom as four nations, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, is in doubt. Ahmed Kabbella, London.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the US-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. The Sunday attack came as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel for talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility, but the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
The Ramadan crescent moon has been sighted in Iran. And this means the fasting month begins on Wednesday. During the holy month, Muslims abstain from eating and drinking from dawn to dusk as a means to practice self-restraint. In Iran, restaurants close during the day and instead work longer hours overnight. This is especially the case for confectionaries, where they add these special sweets to their shelves every year in Ramadan.
Iranians usually break their fast by eating sweet and energetic foods. So every year in Ramadan, we bake zulbia and baklava because they refresh the body after hours of fasting. You can find them in every Iranian confectionery during Ramadan.
This is the second year in a row that Muslims observe the fasting month amid the coronavirus pandemic. With Iran now under a partial nationwide lockdown, religious authorities have ordered that all mass religious ceremonies be either canceled or held in open-air environments. with social distancing.
I pray to God to help us overcome the coronavirus. Unfortunately, this year, as in the previous Ramadan, the pandemic has kept us from gathering together to practice the Ramadan rituals.
Ramadan has always been a chance to take part in charity works, and now that the pandemic has unemployed many people, Muslims feel bound to rush for help.
During Ramadan, charity institutes ramp up their activities. This year, many people have lost their income as a result of the pandemic, so more families depend on donations to be able to break their fast.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the lunar calendar, where months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the Earth. And the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. Some Muslim nations, such as Iraq and Lebanon, started the fasting month a day ahead of Iran.
To Muslims, Ramadan is more than just a time to abstain from eating and drinking. They find it an opportunity to purify the soul from materialistic desires and polish it with spirituality. This year, they use the occasion as a chance to ask God to make it the last Ramadan that is marked with the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain is speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him. and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Debate. September 11, the date the U.S. was hit with a terrorist act, it invaded and occupied Afghanistan shortly after that. And it will be the same date that it will withdraw its forces from that country. What does the U.S. have to show for it after almost 20 years of war and occupation? Well, not much, considering that the group it wanted to eliminate won't even attend talks with it, settling only for its ouster. The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the subject of this edition of the debate.
The phrase of September 11 revives the memory of terrorist attacks in the U.S. that later in October 2001 brought the U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan in the name of International Security Assistance Forces, ISAF. Earlier, in a joint press conference with NATO chief, the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said that the two sides would work together on a safe, deliberate, and coordinated withdrawal of their forces from Afghanistan. Officials in Kabul also say the decision would be later discussed by the presidents of Afghanistan and the U.S.
The Afghan government respects the U.S. decision, and the presidents of both countries are going to discuss the issue again. Afghanistan's security and defense forces are capable of protecting the country. They have done so in the past and will do so in the future.
This comes as the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan was agreed between the Taliban and the U.S. during negotiations in the Qatari capital Doha last year.
With such change on Washington's policy, the Taliban has also declared that it's not willing to attend Turkey summit until foreign troops are stationed in Afghanistan. Government officials here believe the presence of foreign troops in Afghanistan is not the main cause behind Taliban's decision not to attend Turkey summit, but it's a pretext for the militants to further wage the war in the country.
Taliban has wasted time over the past year by fueling the flames of war instead of trying to bring peace. The presence of foreign troops in Afghanistan is a pretext for the Taliban to continue their illegal war against our people.
As the Taliban has become a serious headache for the U.S. despite 20 years of fighting, many here argue that there would be no win for no one via military ways. Therefore, they want Taliban and other players to set aside their differences and reach a comprehensive agreement in order to lead this wounded part of the world to peace and stability. However, the issue of withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan is not the only matter of concern for the Taliban, as there are some other key factors that affect groups looked toward Turkey summit, including the fate of political system in Afghanistan. Some observers worry that with foreign troops gone, Afghanistan will witness a rise in violence, but that can't be further than the truth, as Afghan forces are well equipped to fight any security threat rapidly and effectively. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
For guests joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco. We also have Syed Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Becker, let me first start with you. Almost no sooner did the U.S. President Joe Biden begin his speech today, which is ongoing as we speak, did the words come out of his mouth that said, our reasons for staying in Afghanistan have become increasingly unclear. After 20 years for the U.S. President to say that, it speaks volumes. What is your impression of what he has said there?
Well, there's very little honesty that comes from the U.S. government on foreign policy issues, and this is another example of not facing up to the reality of what has really been the role of the United States in Afghanistan. The common saying is that it's the longest war, or second longest war in U.S. history, and it started in 2001, but really the war against Afghanistan started in 1979 and was later confessed to by U.S. leaders after they were out of office. So really we've seen more than four decades of U.S. intervention, which has wreaked havoc on the country. First it was to overthrow a progressive government that attempted in the late 70s and 1980s to implement changes that would improve the lot of people who were still living in a semi-feudal society in most of Afghanistan. And we see in 2001, after the U.S. had been out of Afghanistan for a period of years, and go back in on the pretext that this was, you know, as revenge, and it really was for revenge, but the pretext that this was somehow to help people, help women, that was a theme that was played. All U.S. intervention has done in Afghanistan is wreak destruction on the country and the people of Afghanistan at an enormous cost in human lives and treasure.
Syed Mohsen Abbas, I mean, really, if you really want to look at what has happened there, 20 years of the U.S. being there, along with some of the other NATO member countries, at one point, I believe, the highest number came in at around 100,000 troops, maybe a little bit more. And yet you're dealing with 5,000, 6,000 Taliban. I mean, why did the U.S. and its NATO partners, countries, not be able to defeat the Taliban?
I think it's a false strategic analysis on the part of the American establishment that they could ever achieve victory. That's the best I can say for them. The other is to say that cynically they knew perfectly well that they wouldn't be able to do this. In fact, they just needed to be there for their own geopolitical and resource rate agendas. You know, there is far more wealth in Afghanistan than people realize. There's far more also strategic importance given the, for instance, the Russian presence, the Chinese Belt Road Initiative, Pakistan and India, you know, so huge interests, to not least of all to mention that the Islamic Republic of Iran, who the Americans have been after, is next door as well. So Afghanistan was vital, not for the reasons they were saying, which was to hunt down terrorists, but rather for the purpose of advancing their own greed and their own hegemony in the region. Now, the net result you talked about, after 20 years of what I call occupation of Afghanistan, and that despite the fact they declared victory, laughably along the way as well, they've used torture, they've done the rendition exercises on individuals, 15,000-pound bombs, drone strikes, and tens of thousands of troops, as you've mentioned, have been involved. But today, it's still the Taliban that control the vast majority of Afghanistan and who are present in most of the country. Of course, what other results? Well, we can see that Al-Qaeda, which was only based in remote parts of Afghanistan when they said they would go in at best, and even there we know that the Al-Qaeda link is very strongly connected to American deep state itself. Whilst it was supposed to be in remote parts of Afghanistan before, it's sprouted globally, you know, with franchises in Iraq, which we all know very well, you know, the ISIS AQI fraternity, in Yemen, in North Africa, the Levant, and beyond. So Al-Qaeda eventually transformed into ISIS, that we know, in Camp Buka at Abu Ghraib, after its leaders met with former members of Saddam's regime. That was another gift from the American war of terror that they inflicted on Afghanistan, which had reverberations everywhere. Of course, hundreds of thousands killed, maimed, or displaced by both invasions that they carried out as well. I mean, I could go on, but I think that's kind of gives people an idea of the huge global terrorism which is increased because of the so-called American intervention to stop terrorism. You know, it's been an absolute disaster.
Yeah, Richard Becker, just a few years back, based on a 2,000 pages of previously, at that point, unpublished notes of interviews with the generals and people who played a direct role in the war, and diplomats to be included in there, and aid workers, you name Afghan officials, part of this really vast investigation. The findings that came out were shocking. One of them, U.S. officials constantly had said that they were making progress in Afghanistan, but they failed to tell the truth about the war throughout the campaign, making rosy pronouncements that they knew were false and hiding unmistakable evidence that the war had become unwinnable. Now, this is going back a few years when the findings came out, referring back to the years before that. If that was the case, then what reasons did the U.S. have to continue for what this is stated, one of the findings, that it was an unwinnable war?
Well, there's actually nothing new about this. I mean, that's what the Pentagon Papers were all about back at the time of the Vietnam War, after the war had gone on and huge casualties had already taken place and massive destruction of Vietnam. And then the Pentagon Papers came out, and the government tried to put on trial, Daniel Ellsberg, the person who leaked the Pentagon Papers, who had worked for Rand Corporation. And what his crime was he exposed the reality of that war, and that after years of the American public being told, oh, we're winning, and just, another 50,000 troops, and it'll be all over. I remember that when I was young. They knew from 1965 that they couldn't really win the war, but that had to be kept secret from the people. And the same thing has happened also with Chelsea Manning and those who work with Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, who revealed the reality. Their crime, if there was honesty in the system, they would charge them with the crime of exposing U.S. war crimes. So the military always wants to go on until they get to a certain point and they know that it's impossible. But as your other guest said, Afghanistan has tremendous strategic importance. It's surrounded by several other states, and states that are in contention with the United States right now. And the idea that, not that the Taliban, I don't believe, has sympathy with Russia or China or any of that, but the fact that Afghanistan could slip out of the grasp of the United States, the strategic grasp of the United States, that's what really kept them in the war for all this time, when knowing that they weren't going to be able to win. And I would say, add one thing to this, is that for years and years, they had known this. And still, they kept setting U.S. troops, and just to show the cynicism of the Pentagon and the war makers, they kept sending U.S. troops and other NATO troops out into forward operating bases, FOBs as they were called, really not for any other reason except to draw fire of the Taliban forces, of the anti-occupation forces, and then the U.S. could use air power to try to obliterate those forces. I mean, that's what people were doing out in the forward operating bases year after year after year, when the military high command knew they couldn't win the war.
Yeah, and taxpayer money there, not to mention the exorbitant amount of money that was spent on a variety of issues in that country, like rebuilding, which never panned out the way that they wanted to. Now, Simos and Abbas, you know, we could talk about how the U.S. has failed, but some of these fine details that came out on this investigation that I referred to are really mind-boggling. And I'm going to quote you what one of the three-star Army generals who served as the White House's Afghan war czar during the Bush and Obama administration. He said, quote, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing there." In addition, he said, "What are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking." What does that say about the U.S. and the way that its army is run?
Well, it says that there's absolutely no common sense and no analysis or genuine purpose for spreading what they often use as an excuse for going in and doing these things. Number one, you know, the idea of catching terrorists, so-called terrorists. Then they had the other one, which is democracy. You know, they've got to, they're out in the world to spread democracy and human rights. These are just three of the lines that they, use as a way of pushing their armies in. And of course, it's an industrial military complex, which one has to ask a serious question. Who's actually in control of this industrial military arms complex? Is it the Defense Secretary of America? Is it the Senate? Is it the President of America? Because, quite frankly, who's going to take responsibility for all these millions of deaths which this industrial military complex has perpetrated across that region? Because there are millions. Once you count Iraq, you count Libya, you count, Yemen, you count the Afghan region, the wars on Iran, let's not forget. All of these were initiated by that same machine. So, you know, what is the world going to do about that machinery, that industrial military complex, and who actually finances, powers, and manages it? There are a lot of course, questions about the money mafias and those who have corporate interests also using these military machines in order to sell all of their sort of weapons, you know, Raytheon and all the other kind of Boeing and the various, Lockheed Martin, all those who profiteered out of the lives that have been lost are also culpable. You know, there are a lot of criminals that need to be rounded up and taken to account. But of course, Western electorate don't know much, nor do they care very much about their foreign policies. They complain about immigrants, you know, Afghan immigrants when they started coming back here. But actually, if they stop invading other countries, paid more attention to their psychopathic leaders who they vote in, who then go on these war expeditions for their own corporate buddies' interests and their own financial interests, it may mean that even the West would suffer less from terrorism, suffer less from migrant crises, which they're now moaning and complaining about. They would have less anti-terror laws passed, which have been applied in perpetuity by all of these U.S. coalition nations, you know, which changed society here in the West forever. In fact, the march towards capitalist totalitarianism is inexorable, along with COVID. But the wars of terror are actually what initiated those. You know, Islamophobia has gone through the roof in the West. You know, thousands of the coalition troops themselves have been maimed or killed. Those families, all in vain, have lost lost lives, lost people. So the damage and who actually is going to be, if you like, held culpable is the real shame of it, because right. nobody will be, because there is no international body that can actually bring the war criminals like Bush, like Tony Blair, those who've been on these kind of crusades in the Muslim lands. Nobody's bringing them to task. They're running around free.
Right. Well, Richard Becker, if you want to take purely at the numbers here, we know that the U.S. has spent quite a bit of money in this country, not to mention the coalition forces from other countries. If we were to come out with some figures, I'm sure it would be a large figure. You would figure in 20 years' time, if that money was spent in the presence of U.S. forces and other countries' forces for the infrastructure of Afghanistan, that the country would be doing better, a country that's supposedly resource-rich. Kind of mirrors what has happened in Iraq. And it leads one to think, perhaps, that there wasn't really that much of a motivation for the U.S. to make sure that the country was built, its infrastructure, to have advanced. We know it has done some projects. Why wasn't the focus put more on that to at least see Afghanistan prosper, the Afghan people prosper that way?
Well, clearly that is not in the interest. That's not what interests the leaders in the United States, both the politicians on the national level and the military politicians, the civilian politicians and the military politicians. What their real aim is global domination. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot, but the cost that is paid by the people of Afghanistan, the people of the world, by this immense, immense waste of resources. I mean, it's unbelievable. The real military budget of the United States this year, they'll say it's $715 billion, but it won't be. It'll be really $1.2 trillion or something like that to pay for past wars and present wars. And this goes on year after year after year. If we look at what has been spent, you know, in just the last 20 years on wars, the wars in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, but the other wars are against Libya, in Yemen, but the military budget as a whole. And it's a place where these military industrial corporations that your other guest is referring to, they feast on it. They grow richer and richer and richer, but the people pay for it. You know, we just lost a great humanitarian figure opposed to imperialism and domination, Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General. And I traveled with him often into other countries, to other countries to speak, for him to speak, and he was always emphasizing this point, that this was a crime against the people. And he would quote Martin Luther King, who said, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government. That's even more true today than it was then.
Well, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, I'm looking through some of the quotes that Biden has made on this day, coming into the speech that he's made regarding the withdrawal. And another one stands out from what he has said, and that is what he referred to as terrorism. And let me make sure that I quote him accurately, that the U.S. will continue to work to prevent the reemergence of terrorism. You would think 20 years would be enough, and it can't even provide, it can't even do that for its own country. How can Biden even make a claim to that effect when it has failed, not only in this country, Afghanistan, but also, for example, in Iraq?
Well, the claim is I'm just going to have to back up, I think, a little bit. Yeah, my battery, sorry. Yeah. Your question is obviously, first of all, I have to say how ludicrous the statement Biden made is. The bottom line is that America, you know, has now got a reputation worldwide, and it's renowned for that reputation of torture, and it's lost its credibility as a defender of justice. It's lost its credibility as a sort of a purveyor of human rights. The UK also comes in second place as a complicit sideshow to that. You know, the crowning achievement of this this war of terror on the Afghani people is that now the Taliban, who they fought, are going to oust anybody that the Americans want in there, and their points for a return to power. So the legacy of war and terror in the invasion of Afghanistan should never be forgotten. It can be summed up by saying it's probably the most destructive single biggest failure of the 21st century, certain for the Americans.
Thank you very much for that. Let me thank our guests. Unfortunately, we don't have any more time. Richard Becker spoke to us from San Francisco, from the Answer Coalition, and you were just listening to Simo Sinabas, journalist and political commentator there from London. Thank you for your contribution. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitavlei and the entire team in the Capitol, Hebron, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
There is vast support across the U.S. for defunding police departments and shifting funding to nonviolent alternatives to policing. A Data for Progress poll published earlier this month, for example, found that 65% of voters in the U.S. would support reallocating some of law enforcement budgets to support such non-police first responder programs. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Residents of Minneapolis Suburb Rise Up Against Police Killing of Don't Write. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Following the police perpetrated killing of a 20-year-old black man in the Twin Cities suburb of Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, hundreds of residents demonstrated outside of police headquarters and throughout the city on Sunday night, April 11th, into Monday morning, April 12th. About 200 protesters near police department headquarters chanted the name of Don't Write, who police shot to death hours earlier. Police responded to the protest against police-perpetrated violence with flashbangs and tear gas to disperse the crowd, claiming rocks were thrown at the building during the uprising. Governor Tim Walz deployed the National Guard to the area. Brooklyn Center Mayor Mike Elliott placed a curfew on the city until 6 a.m. on Monday morning, April 12th. Police reportedly pulled right over just before 2 p.m. Central Time on Sunday, April 11th in Brooklyn Center. Wright's mother told the reporters that her son had called her to get information about the vehicle's insurance, as his family gave the car to Wright just 2 weeks prior. Wright's mother said her son was pulled over for having air fresheners on his rearview mirror. Police allege Wright tried to re-enter his vehicle after being confronted over an outstanding warrant. The officer then shot Wright, who drove several blocks before crashing into another vehicle. He was pronounced dead at the scene of the crash. While it is technically against state law to hang objects from the mirror of a moving car, the Minnesota branch of the American Civil Liberties Union expressed deep concerns that police here appear to have used dangling air fresheners as an excuse for making a pretextual stop, something police do all too often to target black people. During a press conference on Monday, April 12th, Brooklyn Center Police Chief Tim Gannon alleged that police-perpetrated killing was accidental. As I watched the video and listened to the officer's commands, it is my belief that the officer had the intention to deploy their taser but instead shot Mr. Wright with a single bullet, Gannon said. This appears to me from what I viewed and the officer's reaction and distress immediately after that this was an accidental discharge that resulted in the tragic death of Mr. Wright. Many on social media did not accept that rationale as acceptable. Ben Passer, lead director of Energy Access and Equity at the Minnesota-based clean energy nonprofit Fresh Energy, opined on the matter, saying that Wright's killing being an accident doesn't make it any better. The power to end the life shouldn't rest in the hands of a single officer's careless decision. An accident shouldn't result in the loss of life, Passer said. Simon Balto, a professor of Black Studies at the University of Iowa, noted the significance of the police-perpetrated killing taking place during the ongoing trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who killed George Floyd last year after kneeling on his neck for several minutes. Don't Wright was killed in the Twin Cities for the same reason that George Floyd was killed in the Twin Cities. Because the first language of police and the organizing principle of policing is violence, and because white supremacy is a structuring element of the whole system, Balto said on Twitter. There is vast support across the country for defunding police departments and shifting funding to nonviolent alternatives to policing. A Data for Progress poll published earlier this month, for example, found that 65% of voters in the U.S. would support reallocating some of law enforcement budgets to support such non-police first responder programs. Support for such measures reaches across partisan lines, with majorities of Democratic and Republican-leaning respondents in the poll backing the idea of reallocating police funding towards such programs.
Iran, IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.